Welcome to The Sustainable Life. This is Josh Spodek, and I'm here with Alden Wicker. Alden, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. And it's funny because I've been looking forward to meeting you in person and learning more about what you've written about. And I'm fascinated by it, horrified by it, and really want to get these things out there, help you spread your message. So you the book To Die For is what led me to find you. And before we start talking about that and what drew you into the research that you found, I think it's tempting for people to feel like, oh, she was looking for that. Or can you tell us about your background before that, before what we're mainly going to talk about? Because I think it's a lot closer to where many people are.
Well, how far back do you want me to go?
I guess what your interests were, I mean, I know that you were into food and safety and food and fashion and beauty before.
Yeah.
And was it looking into what goes into the clothing that we're wearing?
Yeah. Well, I've always had some interest in sustainability. I actually started a blog when I graduated in 2009, and it was around all things sustainable. Very casual, one of those like girl in the city blogs that were really popular at the time. And fashion was just one topic in there, but I was very interested. I started thinking about fashion because all these other ways you can be sustainable because the food movement had such a profound impact on my life.
Mm-hmm. And that's like Michael Pollan.
Michael Pollan, Food Inc., like that whole thing teaching me the basics, just like eat. If you eat whole food that's local, it'll impact your health positively. And so I was interested in all these other sustainability things and like where to get my nails done. It's non-toxic or, you know, trying to live like a normal life, but a little bit more sustainable. And so I started writing more and more about fashion from 2013 when I relaunched my blog as ecocult.com. Mm-hmm. And fashion, again, was just one of the topics. But because there were so many other great websites out there that were covering clean beauty and food, obviously, and all these other topics, energy, things like that, I was one of the very few people that was writing about fashion, sustainability, where our clothing is made. And then when Rana Plaza happened, which is the garment factory collapse that killed over 1,100 garment workers in Bangladesh in 2013, suddenly it was a topic that people were really interested in. I think people didn't understand before then that there were people making your clothes, not robots, and how much of a problem it was. So it became my beat, essentially. Like, I was the sustainable fashion girl.
Did you jump from being a blogger to, because I think of you now, I mean, you're in everything. I mean, when did you start writing professionally? Or was that in this time too?
Yeah, I actually interned at Huffington Post Green in, I think, I want to say 2010. And then I was hired at a media site to cover personal finance for women. So very service oriented, which I still bring a lot into my work, sort of looking at how the broader system, especially fashion, but everything is impacting women and how women move through the world. And so, yeah, I started writing freelance about fashion in particular, in 2012. Mm-hmm. And then I just started writing for larger and larger publications because people were realizing that this was a problem and that fashion has a huge impact on the worldwide economy, on millions of people. It really touches everything, agriculture, chemicals, you know, economic development, politics. Like, it's a really important industry that isn't taken seriously by a lot of journalists or researchers, not as seriously as I think it should be taken.
And did you have any anticipation of what you were going to find when you learned about the airline stuff?
No. I mean, I up until 2019, when all of this started happening, I really did not. I had never heard of fashion being toxic or having an impact on one's health. So I knew that beauty products were a problem and personal care products were a problem and perfumes and fragrances and the plastics that are in our kitchen. I knew that all these were a serious problem for our health. Food, obviously, but a little bit of furniture too, paints, right? You have VOCs and paints and all these things, but fashion, I hadn't heard a whisper about it potentially being toxic. All I knew, and I think all what a lot of people believe now is a problem, is like the potentiality for conventional cotton products to still have pesticides from the field on them, which is actually not a problem at all, because cotton is so heavily processed when it moves from field to the store. So I was like, okay, this isn't a problem. But the issue with that thinking and belief is that it's really hard to get people to, you can get people to care about garment workers and climate change. And, you know, when you show them pictures that are of rivers in Asia that are red and foaming, they're like, oh, that's awful. And they might ask you what to do or how to fix it or anything, but that priority falls all the way to the bottom of somebody's priority list when they're actually out in the world, because they want things that are cute. They want things that are in their budget. And when you're juggling a lot of different things as a human, right? Like getting food on the table or advancing in your career or relationships, like the fate of a garment worker that you're never going to meet is really hard to keep centered in your mind. So I just wasn't seeing any evidence that educating consumers was making any difference whatsoever in their shopping habits. In surveys, people will tell you, they'll swear up and down that they will pay more for sustainable fashion. Survey after survey. Oh, yes, absolutely. I would pay more for sustainable fashion. And that is not borne out by any economic indicators, by like shopping or like anything, you know. It's just like, it's just not happening. And so when I heard that the Delta airline attendants were suing.
Before you go into that.
Yeah.
One last question.
Yeah.
If someone had asked you, what do you think the problems would be, or how big do you think the problems would be? Can you fancy what you might have guessed?
In terms of like chemicals, hazardous chemicals in clothing?
Yeah.
If somebody asked me, I would have been like, oh, I haven't heard. I've heard no evidence for that. So I would have dismissed it.
Yeah, I think that's fairly common.
Cool.
And that's what I want to be sure that was the case, because it could have been you were a muckraker from the beginning. And anyway, of course, so 2019 and Delta,
mm-hmm.
What happens?
Sometimes when I listen to, I'm a big fan of Esther Perel, and like she'll have things and going on in the background. So it happens to be the biggest ones.
She's speaking in New York.
Yeah, I'm not going to be here, unfortunately, but I saw that.
Are you in the summit by any chance, or?
Oh, Summit at Sea?
Yeah.
Oh, I was pitched to it. They expressed some interest, but I haven't heard from them, so maybe not.
Okay.
My husband DJed last year, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I went to one in LA in 2018, mm-hmm. and actually later today I'm going to an event in Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Soho. It's called Soho Works, but it's in Brooklyn.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back.
Okay, yeah.
So if someone, what did I say? If someone had asked, what would you?
Oh, you asked, you asked me about Delta.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, so, yeah. So in 2019, there was news that Delta airline attendants were suing Lands' End, who had made their uniforms, because they said the uniforms were making them sick. And then as I looked into it more, this had already happened at Alaska Airlines, at American Airlines. It's still happening at Southwest Airlines. They would get new uniforms, and then a good portion of the, somewhere around like 1 in 5 of the attendants would start reporting reactions, really serious reactions, like reactions that you're not just going to wave away. You know, it would start with rashes or chemical burns that look like sun poisoning or a cough, and then it would progress into racing heart and losing hair. Some attendants went bald, and the rashes would get so bad that they would bleed. Extreme fatigue, just like all the things like that come with a lot of, you know, like just brain fog and just not being able to function when they got on the plane and they were around their colleagues, or even when they would, you know, when they would put the uniform on. And so when I heard about that, I was like, wait, clothing can be toxic? Like this, what's going on here? And so I started digging around, and I did an article for Harper's Bazaar that was not looking into that story in particular because I knew it was a really important story. And I knew also that it was just a huge story that required a lot of care for the attendees because they had already been really kicked around by these large corporations, the fashion brands, the apparel brands, and the airlines that employed them. But I wrote a simple thing that was just like, hey, like, actually, there's a lot of evidence that clothing can be toxic, that there are things have been found in clothing that are toxic. PFAS, which is, you know, the Teflon chemical that makes things waterproof or is in, you know, nonstick pans, carcinogenic, reproductive toxic. So we know that that's in clothing. You know, other tests were starting to come out around, you know, lead being in clothing. And, you know, I'd heard women talking about, mostly women talking about how, oh, I'm allergic to polyester. I itch when I have this. You know, there's just been a lot of evidence that was starting to point towards this being a problem. And so I wrote a short article and then I decided that I wanted essentially to write a whole book about it. Like I was like, this is a book length topic. I mean, when I came up with a book pitch, I was like, I had this feeling of like, I hope this isn't a stretch. Like, I hope that, you know, I was a little bit worried about writing a book where I was like, there's a little bit of evidence over here and there's a little bit of evidence over here. And this is something that, you know, we should probably be paying attention to. And what I found when I got into the book is that this has been an open secret in the fashion industry for 150 years. Like, people have known that this is a problem and it's just been buried under apathy, under, you know, these very profitable industries.
I just put my fingers together, my thumb to do that motion of money. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just really, it's been effectively hidden, not only from consumers, but from doctors, public health researchers, all these people that, you know, have been raising the alarm about other industries and how they're affecting us. But this is just like not been on the radar of anybody. And once I started looking into it, it was like, I would just tell people what I was working on. They'd be like, oh yeah, I had a reaction to clothing. And it's just so widespread, but nobody's put all the dots together and named it. And it was shocking.
So the flight attendants was the entree, but that's not at all, that just happens to be one particular acute place where there's legal action going on that got your attention.
Yeah.
But that's not at all what that's like a tiny little piece of the whole thing. It's a global thing that's been going on since Mad Hatters.
Yeah.
And people know about it, but no one's put it together.
Right, right. All right.
Can you talk about more of beyond the flight attendants? Maybe you could describe, all right, it sounds like you've got a master's in chemistry now as a result or in of organic chemistry.
I would
chemistry.
Say an undergraduate organic chemistry pre-med, maybe.
So I'm kind of curious, can you describe some of the effects on most of my listeners are going to be Americans and British and Australians and English-speaking countries. The effects on the people that they might know what happened to them, garment workers themselves.
Yeah.
And then also, what's this chemistry? How many, we're talking about tens of thousands of chemicals. And can you describe the impossibility of finding them and all the testing that you've done and the costs involved and how it's impossible for someone to keep up with this stuff?
What's interesting about fashion is that it has probably more complex chemistry than almost any other consumer product, which is ironic because it doesn't come with an ingredient list, mostly because of that, actually. So, you know, you pick up a cleaning product. If you're allergic to something, you can look at, see if it's on a food label. You can, you know, make sure if you have eczema, you can make sure not to, you know, get something at the store. But fashion doesn't come with a complete ingredient list. It just says, like, you know, certain percentage polyester, cotton, anything under 5% of the weight of a garment, it doesn't count. You don't have to list it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he's wondering. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of these chemicals that can be in fashion, they can be harmful at the parts per billion level. Like PFAS is harmful at the parts per billion level. And so you have everything. I mean, you have, like I said, like they found lead, arsenic, all the, you know, these heavy metals, chromium in there. So you have those. You have carcinogens, like certain dyes, azo dyes that can be used that are carcinogenic. You have reproductive toxics. So you have bisphenol A, BPA, you have phthalates, you have PFAS, again, is also a reproductive toxic, which can affect your hormone system, which affects everything. And so the ways these things, and then you have sensitizers. So you just have things that, you know, give you a rash or set off your immune system. So these can manifest in so many different ways. So some acute reactions, right? A rash, hives, you might be itchy right away. So that's some of the ways you can notice what's going on immediately. But then you have like long-term effects. So a lot of the chemicals that have been found in fashion have been linked to autoimmune disease, cancer, you know, infertility, other reproductive harms, you know, anything that your hormone system controls. So your energy levels, your metabolism, your skin appearance, you know, your like everything. And so like you name the chronic illness, it could be exacerbated by chemicals that are used and have been found in fashion. And so it's sort of all encompassing, which I know is hard to believe, but it's just like tens of thousands of chemicals. If you tried to list all the ingredients that were in a brightly colored, you know, blended fiber garment with, you know, lining and everything, it would just, the physical tag would be like, it would be pages long of just stuff that could be in there. And so some of the people I talked to who have been affected by this, you know, the flight attendants had it worse, but they also could pinpoint what was happening because they had high performance uniforms that were newly synthetic, that had not only the normal stuff, but also, you know, fire retardants put on them, stain proof, mold proof, super cheap, brightly colored, all this newfangled stuff. But they knew what was happening to them. I mean, it still took some of them months to figure out, you know, what was going on, but they all got the uniforms at the same time. They would wear them for half a day, a full day. They could talk to each other and say like, oh, you have headaches? Like I have a cough, and could see that this was happening to all of them, or not all of them, but a good portion of them. And so they could figure it out. But if you or I were having problems like persistent skin problems, or God forbid, we were fighting or in remission from cancer and we're trying to get carcinogens out of our food and out of our kitchen and out of our medicine cabinet, you know, a lot of people would not connect it to this. I mean, I had a conversation actually with a very dear friend of mine and her husband this week, and they're going through IVF, and they've been through two hellacious rounds, and they're on the third round, and she read my book, and she like switched her underwear, she threw out all of her makeup, like, you know, they took all the plastic out of their kitchen, and this round is already going so much better because they have that information. But most, even the fertility doctors who do say like, hey, here are some things you can do to improve your egg quality, they don't know that fashion can contain BPA and phthalates. And if you go to a skin doctor, a lot of them will say, what detergents are you using? What lotions are you using? But they won't say, what clothes are you wearing? So it's horrendous and very buried.
I think of these chemicals as, I think as PFAS or maybe BP, like these are things that when they put them, the runoff in rivers turn frogs female to male or male to female.
Right.
Like that's, and I don't think people know precisely what's contributing to sperm counts being down by half globally, or I believe that the rates of birth defects are going up as well.
Yeah. Well, the Endocrine Society, which is a global group of doctors who care for people with endocrine-related illness, and also researchers, just put out a new report saying, like, it's the endocrine disruptors that they attribute a large portion of illnesses, some deadly, cancer, you know, reproductive harm, all sorts of things, to the prevalence of endocrine disruptors, these hormone-disrupting chemicals in our environment and homes.
And okay, so I'm wearing clothes, and I understand that little babies absorb through the skin.
Yeah.
And so I can see skin ailments. And by the way, I'm thinking about how I've been getting eczema in the winter. but I'm also have these new gloves. I'm like, I didn't get it before.
Mm-hmm.
So
on your hands?
Yeah.
Only on your hands?
Yeah, it hasn't gone up to my forearms. And I had an ex-girlfriend who had it. And now I'm wondering, maybe she, like, because I don't think it's something that spreads, like, from contact.
No, no.
And I didn't have it when she had it, but now I have it. I mean, it's gone now. It's like, sadly, March means it was almost 70 degrees yesterday, but
yeah.
It's another climate issue or environmental issue.
Right.
So I guess I'm not going to put on the gloves until next winter, so I'm not going to test it between now and then. But now I'm like, a question I want to ask you later is how the world looks different knowing what you know. Because, I mean, there's so, you know, one Earth Day a few years ago, I was invited by Lululemon to do a talk there. And the guy who organized it, or one of the people who organized it, loved...
You know Lululemon is being sued for greenwashing, right?
Well, I didn't... Now I know. I didn't know.
Yeah.
But this guy was like, he loves the store because he loves the community. He described how everyone in the store is all on the same page. You know, like some people work there and some people shopping there, but
yeah.
There's this community feel. And then he says he's an Australian surfer. And it dawned on him that this is more like true cost stuff. But
yeah.
he was like, everything they sell here is plastic.
Yeah.
Everything here is going to end up in the ocean. And he was really struggling with it in the way of, it's difficult for someone to see something when their salary depends on not seeing
yeah.
it in that
yeah,
kind of way.
Absolutely.
And so Lululemon's everywhere. And then they sponsored all the other brands that are like it.
Yeah.
Which it seemed to me all, it seems like the more something's performance wear,
mm-hmm.
the more likely it's got, like all these things that waterproof and wrinkle-free and all that.
Yeah.
Every one of those seems to me now to say poisoned chemicals.
Yeah, I mean, that's not inaccurate. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because like, this is pure speculation, but I wish somebody would do a study on the prevalence of cancer rates in people who wear a lot of performance gear. Because it's like cliche almost at this point where they're like, it's crazy. She got cancer. She was like a marathon runner and like big hiker, you know, and like just so healthy and like exercised all the time. And I'm just like wondering of like, is that the thing? Like, you know, like if you're, look, there's increasing evidence that when you sweat in stretchy polyester spandex stuff, you're drawing out with your sweat all the stuff that's in there.
The salt water is really, brings a lot of things into solution.
Salt water, but like also there's like body oils and like, yeah. you know, like bacteria and like all this stuff. So yeah, it's drawing all that stuff out. Now, polyester spandex has almost, the evidence is showing that like it almost always has BPA in it. So you're like pulling BPA out and you're also pulling out like the anti-odor nano silver technology and like the, you know, the dyes, right?
If it's bright color, that means lead. Is that a fair assumption?
No, that's not a fair assumption.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that. I would not say that. I would say if it's bright colored, and look, anything that is synthetic. Okay, so if you imagine trying to dye a plastic bag or a plastic water bottle, like how would you do that? And so you can imagine that the kind of dye that you need to dye plastic, polyester, nylon, acrylic, like you need a very potent dye. That's dispersed dyes, and they're proven immunosensitizers. Some of them are known carcinogenic. And so if you're like sweating in every day, you're like doing your morning workout, you're like, you know, training for a marathon in a black, like tight sports bra or like a black tight, you know, polyester sweat wicking shirt. Like you're just drawing all that stuff out onto your skin.
And okay, does it get into your body? And then if so, how?
That is a disconnect right now because we've shown that, for example, children who wear stain-proof school uniforms are getting like a certain amount of PFAS exposure to their skin every single day, but nobody's measured like how much of that gets through the skin into the body. But again, PFAS is toxic in the blood at parts per billion levels. So it's not a far, like, to me, that's enough evidence to be like, I'm not wearing PFAS, like, waterproof stuff. Is it enough evidence to make a, like, to, well, you know, New York State and California are saying, like, you can't have PFAS in everyday apparel, and then after that in performance apparel. But, like, because the country runs on sort of, like, a risk analysis thing, which is, like, okay, we know it's hazardous, but can you prove that, like, you know, wearing it is giving people cancer? Oh, you can't? Like, then, you know, that's the way we run our country and our legal system and the way the EPA operates. So for me, it's totally enough. I think for anybody who's worried about, you know, their children or their pregnancy or getting pregnant or cancer or, you know, skin problems or anything like that, I think it should be enough.
There's also, I mean, okay, I mop this floor every week.
Yeah.
And but within hours of it being mopped, it's covered with lint.
Mm-hmm.
And this lint, I think, is coming from clothing.
Right.
And there's certain microfibers all over the place.
Yeah.
And especially kids, I gotta imagine I've heard you say we're inhaling the stuff all the time. So it's like getting into our lungs, getting into our eyes, and that's another vector.
That's another route, yeah. I mean, there was research out of Duke where they were looking at, they just been looking at house dust. They collect house dust and they just analyze it to see what's in there. And like one of the things they were finding was these like compounds are there. Like, where are these compounds coming from? Like, they look kind of similar to fire retardants, but like they're not. And then when Dr. Heather Stapleton, she bought her son a polyester shirt with a pattern, and then he complained that he was itchy, and she pulled it up and like there was a rash on his back in the pattern of the shirt. And so because of that, she threw the shirt into the lab and was like, hey, can you analyze this? And through that, she connected all this stuff in the house dust to these polyester things. And she was just so incensed because like as a mother, she's like, kids are so sensitive and like they're wearing these shirts that are just like doused in these immunosensitizing chemicals, and then they're like crawling around, putting their hands in it, putting their hands in their mouth, they're putting their clothing in their mouth if they're babies, you know, and they're just like, their bodies are so little, they're just getting more of it. And it's she was just like very angry about this.
That's total horror movie stuff right there. I mean, as you said that, there's a scene in some movie, The Howling, I think, where these people are in, there's like a werewolf around,
mm-hmm.
but that was sure yet. And they find this book, it's about werewolves. And there's this one scene, if I remember right, in the movie where they're looking at the book and there's a picture of a coastline of like where some past werewolf activity was. And then they bring the book down and the camera, you see the scene in front of them, it's that scene.
Right.
And that's when you realize, oh my God, like you're surrounded by werewolves.
Right. It's like the calls coming from inside the house.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, it can feel like, I don't want people to feel disempowered by being like, it's tens of thousands of chemicals and there's no ingredient list. And like, you know, because I do want it to be empowering, because I think there's a lot of, you know, I interviewed another woman whose son had just awful eczema. I mean, bleeding, right? Nothing. She was a nurse practitioner. She tried all the creams. She did everything. Like she, you know, switched to hormone-free milk or like got rid of milk completely and like, you know, just did everything she could. And like the one thing that nobody had told her about was the clothing. And when he was able to verbalize, like, I hate my clothing, I don't want to get dressed in the morning, like he would throw these tantrums, that's when she came to that conclusion. But like, Nobody had said, like, try the clothing. And when she switched out the clothing, it got better. And so, like, I'm trying to tell people, like, if you're trying everything, right? If you're about to be hand over $20,000 to a fertility clinic, like, this is something you can do to make that process go better and have a better outcome, which is switching out your clothing as well as, you know, not microwaving things in plastic and blah, blah, blah. Like, if you're the kind of person who buys organic food, like make sure you're not also buying fast fashion, because that fast fashion could be doused in much more even talk, like it could have pesticides on it, highly hazardous pesticides on it from, you know, being in a warehouse or being shipped, right? So this is something else that you can do to like improve your health and like protect your family.
You said fast fashion, but I've also heard you say that the high-end brands doesn't mean you're protected.
Not necessarily. I mean, look, there is a floor below which you are gambling, which is ultra fast fashion brands, Shein, Temu, anything you buy off of Amazon.
These things. I've heard you talk about them. I'm like, what is that?
Okay. Yeah. So apparently you don't have a tween in your life. So yeah, Shein, I mean, it's like between Shein and Temu, they're shipping millions of packages per day straight into the country from the factory to your front door. And so like nobody is checking these packages to see what's in them. Like you could open them and they might smell like gasoline and you're like, how could this happen? Well, nobody cares. They're not being checked. So they're very dangerous. And like if you're paying $5 for a dress or something like that, or like $3 for a bathing suit, there is no way the factory that came from is buying certified safe chemicals. They're buying whatever the cheapest chemical is from the dude down the street. So like that's very dangerous.
So that's not gambling. That's just throwing money out the window. And now it was throwing your health out the window.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, but you know how like teenagers are, right? So I've talked to a lot of parents who are like, oh, like my teenage daughter is like buying all this stuff from Shein. And like, short of grounding them from the internet, like how am I going to keep them from buying this stuff? Because it's so cheap, right? And I'm like, okay, the only thing I can think of to convince them, because I was a teenager once, I went to the tanning salon. Like, I didn't think about my future health, is telling them that like, if they have body acne, it might be coming from this clothing. Like, I didn't realize that my body acne was coming from this clothing until like I started buying more and more, you know, cotton workout gear and stuff, because it started because I would be like, oh, I hate wearing, like, I'd be like, oh man, like if I wear polyester leggings for more than a few hours, I get like really itchy. And like, I don't want to wear these when I'm traveling, you know, for a long time. So I'm going to start buying cotton ones. And then, so I stopped wearing a lot of these things, you know, because I noticed that I would get itchy if I was wearing synthetic yoga leggings for many hours. So I started wearing cotton leggings, especially when I was traveling or, you know, and then during the pandemic, I stopped wearing anything but cotton sweatpants. I didn't wear black nylon tights anymore. And then when I put these things back on, I've just noticed like immediate reaction. It's sort of like going on an elimination diet where you like get dairy out or you get certain nuts out or you get gluten out. And then you like add it back in to see how your body reacts. And I was like, oh my God, like I've been so upset about this for so many years. And like, this is what's making my body break out, which is the synthetic clothing. And so that's what I tell parents. I'm like, just tell them it's giving them butt meat and like, see if that helps.
Now, I want to get to later about how legislators are responding to this and what we can do about it there.
Yeah.
But I want to get more into you've been to the factories, you've talked to garment workers, you've seen the rivers. What's it like? I mean, I guess most of this is happening far away. Most of this from us.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, it's not all happening far away. I mean, I would say that the Cape Fear watershed in North Carolina, is historically, you know, tons of textile work being done there. Not as much anymore, but still there. I mean, the Cape Fear watershed is incredibly polluted with PFAS and 1,4-dioxane, which is a probable carcinogen because of textile manufacturing here in the United States.
So not far away.
Yeah, there's tons of Superfund sites, which are the federally designated incredibly toxic sites all over the United States because of textile manufacturing. So it's definitely happening here, but yeah, it's worse over there. It's happening again, even though we know it's bad, and it's happening worse, you know, in Asia and Africa. Yes.
You've talked to people there, you've seen their situations. What's it like?
Yeah. So I went to Tier 4 in Tamil Nadu. And so this is a huge place for dye houses, especially cotton, but synthetics as well. And they're like the farmland all around this place is just ruined. You can't grow anything. The rivers are incredibly toxic.
What do they look like?
So I looked at the one river running through Tirupur, and I couldn't even see the water because it was just like, it was dry season. So it was just like covered with like plants and stuff.
Come on.
But I mean, India is India, you know, like it's a really tough place to visit because you smell a lot of trash burning. I saw a lot of pictures because it got really bad about 10 years ago, bad enough that something had to be done. And so there was this really quite cute report project led by a science teacher at a girls' school where they went around and they like sampled a bunch of wells and rivers, and they took pictures of little kids like with their bodies covered in boils because they had gone swimming in the reservoir. And they have a lot of open wells, and so it was just like black water. And so anyway, they ended up I really wanted to go there because they hadn't solved the problem, because once you put that many toxins into a watershed, it doesn't go away. Like they've poisoned the farmland for the next 100, 200, 300 years. Like it's still bad. But the high court said that none of the dye houses were allowed to discharge liquid waste. So now they have these legally required water purification and circulation systems. So that sort of like that part of it had been handled, and I could take a shower there now and I don't have a reaction. It's clean water that's pumped in from elsewhere. They're not putting anything else in there. I mean, there's rumors about, you know, illegal activity. But anyway, so I wanted to talk to garment workers there to see like, okay, if this is a problem for people who are wearing the clothes, clearly it must be a problem for the women who are touching the clothes. And I didn't realize it would be so easy. The first 5 garment workers I met, I asked this question, and one of them was like, oh, me, you know, and showed me. She had scars all over her arm. When she lifted up her sari, she had these cauliflower blisters all over her legs. So she had worked at a cotton factory for a while for export. And there were a lot of problems with that, you know, no bathroom breaks, long hours, all those things. But her health was okay. But then when she switched to working for a synthetic garment factory for the domestic market, which has a lot less restrictions on what they can use, or there's no testing or anything, she ended up developing these skin problems all over her body. And it had gone away because her doctor told her to quit her job, but it was still on her legs, I think, because she was wearing a synthetic sari every day. And so this was a big problem for her. I visited some doctors as well, and they were really dismissive. They were like, oh, it has nothing to do with that. It's just like their poor hygiene on the part of the garment workers. So I feel like they were just being the garment workers, like many women in the United States as well in the Western world, were having their concerns dismissed. Oh, it has nothing to do with it. But yeah, so it's definitely a problem for them as well.
What's been your emotional journey in this, if you don't mind sharing, if that's not too personal? Like, it sounds like a surprise, but I don't know, disgust or confusion, or what's it been like for you personally? Do you mind sharing?
Yeah, I can share. So I think I'm very fortunate that I do not have a chronic illness that needs managing. Until I figured out that I was getting breakouts from clothing, I really was like, oh, this doesn't affect me personally. And so that was fortunate because I was able to go through this with a more outsider's eye and put everything together. But I got angry by the end of researching this book. I mean, the number of people I talk to who have had their lives ruined by the presence of chemicals in fashion, and when they try to do something about it, tell somebody about it, get help for it, set boundaries around it, they are told that what they're experiencing is not real.
You also talked to people in the chemicals industry and people who are running the factories that shoot, like the garment workers aren't choosing what chemicals go.
Right, right, right.
So someone's making this choice. Presumably, either they know the consequences of their choices to other people or they're remaining ignorant, but there's got to be some deliberateness to that.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on who you're talking to. So I talk to people in the chemicals industry that are not the corporate people, but like the, you know, the engineers, you know, and they, like some of these more like Western, not the American ones, but like the European chemical companies, they want to make a good product. They've come up with alternatives. And the fashion brands, because of these, this relentless drive for margins and downward pressure on pricing, they don't want to pay for the safer chemicals. And so then the factories as well, like the dye houses, they don't know what's in the chemicals, the chemical products, like these barrels or powders that they're buying. It's a proprietary secret, business secret of the chemical companies. And so they're incentivized to, so the fashion companies are incentivized by the, you know, by this downward pressure on them. Like nobody, like, okay, let's put it this way. Let me talk about H&M. So H&M actually, as a Swedish company that is 51% owned by this family, has actually been doing a lot of work for a long time on various sustainability things, but like chemicals is one of them. They've been making sure that their clothing does not have hazardous, known hazardous chemicals for like 15, 20 years, maybe. They are currently viewed by the upcoming generation, Gen Z, as too expensive compared to Shein, Misguided, Boohoo, whatever you can find on Amazon or social media. They're like the upscale product.
Right.
And so they've been trying to do the right thing, but they're getting undercut by these other brands. Okay, so that's the downward pressure coming from onto the brands from the broader market. And then that pressure is applied from the brands towards the supply chain, right? The supply chain could be like, look, we are making the right decisions. If you want safe chemistry, if you want to have Okotex certified or GOTS certified, you're going to have to pay a little bit more for, you know, this product. And the fashion brand are like, nope, we're going to switch to your competitor down the street. And so that's the pressure on the factories. And then the factories are like, okay, well, we can't afford to buy these certified safe chemicals from, you know, these large European companies. So we're going to switch to a cheaper chemical from the trader dude and use that because, like, we need to survive as a factory. And so that's why they're making that decision. And then they don't even know what's in there. And, you know, and then who suffers as a result? The consumers, the community around these dye houses that are outputting these chemicals, and the workers in these communities.
It doesn't seem like these, a lot of this clothing is necessary. I mean, how many times do people wear stuff before they throw it out? I mean, the stuff has got to be not built to last.
No, it's not built to last. It's not built to last from a physical perspective and an emotional perspective. I'll talk about jeans because this is my personal bugbear. I feel like, as a woman especially, the moment I invest in a pair of high quality jeans, where I'm like, these are it, I'm going to wear these all the time for 10 years, the whole fashion industry is like, we're going wide leg now, you know? And so, like, there's the physical durability perspective. Like, you have things that have terrible seams that fall apart and they don't fit very well and they look better online than they do when you get them. And if you return them, they go in the garbage, you know, and they're so cheap. And there's no incentive to make high quality things now because, like, nobody's trying them on in the store. They're just like buying them online and they buy several sizes and then they send it back. So they're just engineered to look good, like on a model in like online. And then the emotional durability is that the, you know, you have these TikTok trends sweeping through, like everything's speeding up so that, you know, I personally, like I'm always trying to invest in quality pieces that I can wear for a really long time. And then I go out to like not even a fashion event. I just go out in like New York City. And I look, I had a moment where I was like wearing these really nice jeans that I had invested in. I was in London for a book event and I looked around and I was like, ah, oh, God damn it. Nobody's wearing mom jeans anymore. Mom jeans were the thing. And it's just so frustrating because it's like you have to continually like recenter yourself. It's like an emotional meditative practice almost to be like, it's okay. No one will judge me for what I'm wearing. Isn't really necessarily true. I have so much jealousy for men. It's like you really can just wear the same thing to every event in every country, no matter what.
You're right. This I have Vanessa Friedman on the podcast, and she.
Oh right, yeah.
She rode her bike to big fashion events,
mm-hmm.
and Ed Begley Jr., the actor, takes the bus.
Yeah.
To the Oscars with his daughter.
Yeah, so good.
And we need that. One of the reasons that I try to bring CEOs and movie stars and star athletes onto the podcast is we could, you know, there's Taylor Swift, who is almost certainly in an airplane right now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We have very few role models who are trying to live sustainably.
Yeah.
And people are so quick to divide between individual action. And if they seem to think that individual action means you're not doing systemic change.
Yeah.
Whereas, listen, systemic change begins with personal change,
yeah.
which you might see in the pounds and stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult. Like, on a personal level, like, I wrote an article last year. I mean, this is getting off the topic of fashion, but I wrote an article last year about my serious misgivings about going to Burning Man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I heard this. It was KCR?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I went there once. And I was like, this is the opposite of
it's
this is
so unsustainable.
Yeah, it's not even remotely close. And they all talk like they are.
Right.
As if like the ground is the only measure. I was sickened by it.
You're talking about like the Leave No Trace, like everybody packs out their trash and everything. Yeah. I mean, walking out of Burning Man feels better than walking out of a typical festival where like everybody's just like dropped their stuff on the ground. But just getting there, I mean, and like, there's so much pressure for me. I've been so many times, it's transformed my life from so many, in a good ways, on so many levels, right? Like, a lot of my friends are burners, incredibly accepting, you know, like, sex positive and like wonderful people, right? Diverse, like, all those things. And I love the people who run my Burning Man camp. My husband is a DJ, like, clearly it's important to him. And I, you know, and the women who run my camp were like, we would really love for you to come back next year. Like, you know, I've run meal plan before for this camp. Like, I made sure that we sent all of our stuff to the compost camp. I made sure we had no waste. You know, like, I was really trying hard on all those things. But I was like, I also fly out there and like, there's the only way to power everything that's going on is with gas generators. And I was like, I love you guys. Burning Man has been great. You know, I appreciate it for everything it is and the art and the awe it inspires. And like, I can't go back. But, you know, writing an entire article about it is what's kept me honest, you know, like, because I put it out there about how I feel about it, but it would be so tempting to just go again and participate again in this thing. And and I think it's like one of the biggest things I've had about my footprint over the past 10 years, which is like going out to this place. And so, yeah, it's like a constant practice of recentering yourself and saying like, is this actually going to improve my life or other people's lives? I think about that a lot with conferences and promoting this book, right? Like I just said, I was in London. I've also been in Paris. And I'm like, okay, is the footprint of me going over there and talking to people like, is it outweighed by the good that I'm doing to tell people? And
is it not another alternative which you could achieve yet more?
Right.
That's another thing. No one's like, what else could I do?
Right, right. So it's great that I can do like Zoom webinars and stuff, and I do a ton of those. But being in present in the room with a bunch of people from the fashion industry, telling them about like, you work at this giant fashion brand and you're the person that like does the chemical stuff, like face to face. Hello, hi, I'm here. Like, I'm a real person and I'm telling you about this stuff. Like, that can be that. I feel like that's doing something. Like, go back to your company. Having that personal connection where I'm just like talking to them and they're like, oh yeah, like I'm about to go through, you know, my husband and I are trying to have a baby. And I'm like, ah, okay. Like that, having a cocktail at the thing afterwards is so powerful for networking and making that personal connection and saying like, oh yeah, you know, I have a lot of friends who are going through this too. And like, this is how this connects to your life and your family and your interests. I find that way more powerful than like going digitally to a conference and going into like little breakout rooms, you know, and like just talking at people about this. Like, I do think that's powerful. But again, like I keep recentering myself and saying like, oh yeah, it'd be super fun to like fly here and fly there, but I'm going to say no to that. And I'm going to say no to that. And really, I really think about like, what is that doing?
If you ever want to engage on that, I'm ready for it. I'll leave it out of this conversation. Because I'm also interested in what have been the reactions to, and it hasn't been out that long, but from readers, consumers, industry people, legislators, how's it been received?
It's been received really well. I mean, I have to get people over the threshold to reading the book first, which I think is the hardest part because a lot of people, I think, very rightly so, they see the book, and because they've never heard anything about this, they dismiss it as sort of wellness, like misinformation, right? You know, and it gets there really fast. You know, like people come in on social media and they're like, oh yeah, for sure. And like, you know, like synthetics have bad energy waves.
Oh.
You know, and I'm like, oh, geez. You know, and so I need to get them to read it first because a lot of people, they really do dismiss it as like, oh, wellness influencer BS or whatever. Mm-hmm. Once they read it, the reaction has been incredible. Nobody has disputed the facts and the claims in the book. People who are in the industry are like, yep, nailed it. You know, I've gotten emails from somebody who runs a dye house in Italy and somebody who works on this full-time, the chemical thing full-time in the fashion industry. And then the best responses are from people who are like, I'm crying. I feel seen. This happened to me. Nobody believed me. Like, thank you. You know, my daughter has severe eczema or I was trying to tell my doctor about this, or I work for a fashion brand and I've developed ulcerative colitis. And I read your book and I went into my doctor and I told her about how the symptoms started when I started working at this fashion brand with the factory attached. And she said, yes, I think that's it. And I'm finally like, I'm putting it together and I feel seen. And that's been incredible. I don't know yet. I mean, it's been out for less than a year. And because of the nature of what I do, I'm an investigative journalist. I usually hear about the secret meetings held at corporate like way later, you know? So I don't know what exactly is happening right now at these factories, at these corporate places. But I mean, I've been in the room with some of these big brands and I've talked to them. And so I'm hoping that like these people are saying like, also, this is a liability, right? Like there have been lawsuits there are going to be more lawsuits. And I think that really moves the needle, is for them to take the book and say, look, I read this book. People are more aware of this. There have been lawsuits. This is a risk and a liability if we don't do something about this. And that, I think that can have a really big impact.
How about legislators? One thing, a huge thing for me, is that these lawsuits, there's always some issue of standing, and you have to demonstrate some evidence of, like, to show that it was this garment.
Right.
This period of time is really hard. And yet, if you put carcinogens in the environment, people are going to get cancer.
Right.
Like, there's some miss there of,
yeah,
like, it's okay. Like, you can put carcinogens into the environment or in, you know, specifically in someone's clothing, and that's going to cause cancer.
That, right.
How is that not a crime?
Yeah, it's so interesting because, like, the epidemiology, like, proving, like, I wore this thing and so I now have breast cancer. Absolutely impossible. You're not going to be able to prove that. The flight attendants from American Airlines won a lawsuit against Twin Hill, the maker of their uniforms, because they really were able to prove, like, uniforms were introduced. We all got sick. This is what happened. A jury believed them. Cool. For the average person, like, no, we wear too many different things.
Mm-hmm.
But the lawsuits that have been successful so far, so there was that lawsuit. The other lawsuits have been more around false advertising or false marketing. So they've been like, hey, thanks, period panties. You said your period panties were totally non-toxic and they had PFAS in them. So they didn't admit fault. They did settle with these consumers because it was false advertising. And there have been similar ones like that. And then the final types of lawsuits have been in California under Prop 65. So Prop 65, I actually was explaining this again to my husband yesterterday because we went to this Japanese bodega and we got, like, some fun Japanese snacks. And, like, I would flip them over and they all had Prop 65 warnings on the back. So that I read them out loud. It was like,
what's a snack?
A snack. A snack. So they had, like, these Prop 65 warnings on them. And I was like, oh, this is why I don't usually buy processed food, you know? And it was like, this product could contain lead, arsenic, cadmium, and something else. And I was like, he was like, whoa. And I was like, yeah. So Prop 65 says, if your product contains one of these things that are on this list of carcinogenic, reproductive, toxic ingredients, you have to say that they're in there or they could be in there. And what that does is there's this whole industry set up now where they buy things, they test them, and they find something in there and it's not labeled, then you could be sued. And so a lot of brands will just preemptively, you know, like, I told my husband, I was like, I don't think these little sesame roll things necessarily have arsenic, cadmium in them, but they could. And so, like, the brands just decided to cover their ass and, like, put the label on there. I was like, don't stop eating right now, but, like, I wouldn't make a habit of buying these snacks and eating them every day. That would be dangerous. Now, fashion brands do not, and sheets and, like, mattresses and stuff, do not want to put those labels on their clothing. They don't want to do it. And, like, when they do, like, for example, there was a woman who on social media, like, screenshotted this pop-up on Shein, the Shein site, that said, like, this contains this and this and that. And so they don't want to do that. And so they don't put the labels on there. A lot of the large brands have been sued. They've had settlements where they're like, okay, we're going to get lead out. Okay, now we're going to get cadmium out. And now the next round has been BPA. This is how we know there's BPA in polyester spandex workout gear. So that's the third type of lawsuit of, like, if it's in there and you're not labeling it, then you can be sued. But those things aren't banned in California. It's just, like, you just have to tell consumers they could be in there.
Now, something's going on in New York, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here?
So
this is
the Fashion Act. Yeah. So, well, first I will say that New York and California, which I mentioned, have banned PFAS specifically in everyday apparel, all types of PFAS, specifically in everyday apparel, and then after that, performance apparel.
to the extent that's enforced or enforceable?
Yeah, I think it'll probably end up being the same thing. It's not illegal yet. There's like a runway to get there. But I think what's probably going to happen, and I have to look into this further, is there will be a similar thing popping up where brands are probably scrambling to figure out if they even have PFAS in their stuff, because a lot of them don't even know, and then get it out. And then once this comes into force, somebody could buy it, test it, buy something, test it. If there's a high amount of fluorine indicating PFAS, or they find certain types of PFAS in there, then they could bring a claim or there could be a fine or something. I'm not entirely sure how it's going to work, but yeah.
I'm going to go in a totally oddball direction here.
Okay.
So we're recording. You live in Brooklyn. You're at my place here in Manhattan. And when you came in, you looked over on my counter and you saw all the stuff that's fermenting over there. So see those two jars that are empty?
Yeah.
If you like Japanese snacks, there's a woman in Brooklyn where she makes natto from scratch by herself. Do you know natto? Do you like it?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, natto is like the Japanese, the equivalent of French stinky cheeses.
Oh.
It's an acquired taste. I think my sister lived in Japan for a while, so I learned about it from her. And I think everyone there grows up eating it.
Yeah.
And some people don't like it, and I didn't like it at first, but now I really like it. And I contacted her, and I said, you know, I really like natto, but I don't want to get it. It's always sold in plastic. And I said, can I come to your place with a container and buy it? And she goes, well, I go to Manhattan a fair amount. So she drops, I buy the natto from her. She makes it. And she, when she has an errand to run in Greenwich Village, I meet her.
Yeah.
And so when I was on the Daily Show and when like the news comes over here, I always make sure that it's like prominent. So
yeah, totally.
And I'm talking about her partly because a lot of people here, it's too hard. I can't deal with all that stuff.
Yeah.
You're so privileged. You can afford all these different things and stuff like that. On the other side of the challenge of living more sustainably, people see it as a challenge. But on the other side of that challenge is always community.
Right.
It's always other people.
Yeah.
And with clothing, it's stitching stuff and the one from my mom has saw. But you know, it's family connection like that.
Yeah.
And with food, likewise. I mean, by getting to know the farmers markets vendors, here's my little secret. I'm letting this out. If you go to the vendor, beets.
Yeah.
Turns out that beets were originally a green leafy thing and the bulb part came later, according to my sister. A lot of people just want the beet root.
Yeah.
That's like what's in season right now. So a lot of times the vendor will say, do you want the leaves? And they say no. So they chop off the leaves, put it in a box, take back to the farm to stick in the compost. Well, it's healthy, delicious, nutritious. I go to the same vendors and I ask them, you got any compost? They're like, yeah, take whatever you want. Because they're like one less thing for me to carry back.
Yeah.
So they're grateful for me to get all this like bruised fruits and vegetables and things like that. They're totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't beat free. And it comes from the community. It comes from connecting with people.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you want to get the natto, I'll put it in touch with it.
I would challenge that though, because it comes from a certain type of community. I mean, this is what I love about, you know, one of the reasons why, so pandemic purchase, my husband and I got a little farmhouse up in Vermont. And I love it up there because everybody's like farmer's markets. I get my soap from Jill down the hill, you know, and like you can't do anything online, you know, and so that's great. But also community can work in the opposite direction, which is, you know, especially, okay, I'll put it this way. Like I do not bring up sustainable fashion or fast fashion or anything like that when I'm just like with my friends, because I don't think guilting people or like hitting people with all this information when they're in a relaxed environment is helpful, or it's not helpful for the strength of our relationships, and it doesn't actually like change the system in a way. And so like my friends know that, like, you know, they know what I do. And so I'll be like, oh, that's such a cute dress. And they're like, oh, I got it from Shein. I'm so sorry. And I'm like, whatever. Like, me guilting you is not going to save the world. And that's the reason why I wrote this book, is because, like, I wanted to show people how the choices they make to buy fashion, like with food, can positively impact their health. But when I say, like, the community can work in the opposite direction, which is, like, how far are you willing to go to, like, when you go home for you know, a family meal, like, are you willing to compromise and eat your, like, I was telling you before we started recording, like, every year I make my great-grandmother Morgan's eggnog and I give it out to a bunch of people. And that's my way of building community. But it's full of dairy. Like, it's so unhealthy. And so I'm caught between these two types of community of, or three types of community, right? Like, do I try to make it with oat milk this year for people who are dairy intolerant? Do I just ignore that? Do I, and also like mess with this like time-honored family tradition? It seems to be working to make me friends. You know, it, people enjoy it who can drink it, but also like, you know, I mean, you go to the farmer's market to get the right stuff and everything. And so like, there's a lot of push and pull between all these different types of community and like who, like which community are you going to be a part of? Are you willing to be the weird person in the old community that you're a part of or among your family, maybe even offend them, right? And then that comes up for fashion as well. Like, I want to look like the kind of person who is with it and fashionable, professional, aspirational, all these things. And I want people to look at me and say, oh, this is something she cares deeply about. And she's not dressed in, you know, like cotton Buddha pants on national television or whatever doing this. And so I think there's, this is getting into a philosophical conversation, but it's constantly like, okay, like how much time am I willing to spend? And am I willing to put in all of this work and risk freaking people out? Or guilting people by doing these things.
My way of saying what you're saying, and tell me if it's too far off, is we have a culture. We have to change culture.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't change culture, it's whack-a-mole with all these other little things.
Right.
There any one thing, like I often say to people, talk about climate only if you specifically want to wreck everything else. Because if you only focus on climate, you're guaranteed to minerals and deforestation.
Yeah, actually, like the thing that freaks people out, that makes people really angry, is the fact that life cycle analyses show that plastic and polyester have a much lower climate impact than natural materials. They just do. We're just really efficient at turning petroleum into polyester, more efficient than we are at powering the gas powered tractors and the inputs and everything to turn a cotton bowl into like a cotton fabric. Like, that's just a fact, and people get really mad about it. And what I would say is like, but that's only if you're looking at the climate impact. If you're looking at the health impacts, the chemicals, the fact that it never degrades, the fact that we're eating these microfibers that are showing up in the guts of fish that we catch, like, it doesn't look as good. So I'm agreeing with you.
Displacing people from their land to get to the minerals underneath, to me, that's a direct human. I mean, I'm a little partial to humans over right. plants and animals and fungus.
Yeah. I mean, this is another thing that I'm really passionate about, which is I did a story that was viral about polyurethane spray foam insulation, because it is seen as a climate initiative to get everybody to use this spray foam insulation because it insulates so well. It is, you can, like, if you want, if you don't want to, like, basically, like, you only need to use a thin amount of it to get really high insulation, lower your oil bills, use less electricity, you're more comfortable, less drafty, you know, like all these things, right? So it's seen as a climate initiative to put it in there. It's so toxic. Mm. It ruins houses, right? It destroys houses because of the moisture management issues and all this stuff. It can cause mold. So if you're just, with this, if you're just looking at like, I want to use less oil to heat my home, great. Fill your walls with spray foam insulation. Mm. But if you want to preserve your house, especially if it's an old house, if you don't want to fill your home with plastic, which off gases isocyanates and other toxic chemicals, if you don't want to potentially get mold, if you don't want to use a fossil fuel, like a fossil based material, then like you should go with something else.
So you're green.
Yeah.
We could go on. I think we should wrap here though.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you'd like to close with?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that, like, I don't want to freak. I mean, I do want to freak people out because it's a really scary thing. But I do want people to leave these conversations. And if they do want to pick up the book and, like, learn more about this particular issue, I want them to leave feeling empowered with a crucial new bit of information in order to reduce their exposure to a lot of these hazardous chemicals. I think this is the missing link. Like, we've been talking about cleaning products and food and beauty products and healthy homes for a really long time. And this has not been talked about. And I think that is, yeah, a huge missing part of the conversation. And also, I would say, is there is legislation that has been passed that is out there, like the Fashion Act in New York, is not specifically around chemicals, but would improve the situation with hazardous chemicals. The EPA is starting to grind into gear and start to address some of these things. And so we're not in a hopeless situation. And especially if people want to make a larger impact on this, you know, it's a little bit harder than going to the farmer's market. I mean, you could probably go to your local alpaca farm and get some nice mittens, but you can call your state representatives and ask them, like, what are you doing to protect us from hazardous chemicals and products? And there's a couple of, also there's Toxic, a Safer States, and Safer States and Toxic Free Future are two advocacy organizations that people can donate to or get involved with.
And I'm going to add something that you can't because you're the writer, but the writing is compelling. I think that's very tempting for people to say, that sounds scary, I don't want to do it. You'd much rather know than not know.
Yeah. It's a quick read, actually. Lots of people have told me, like, I sat down with it and then I just devoured it in a weekend.
Yeah. The writing is really good. It's compelling. It's comprehensive. I mean, there's always more to cover. But read it. It's really...
Thank you.
You're not going to want to put it down.
Thank you.
Yeah, Alden Wicker, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.